Chapter 7. Kit Palfrey had given Gauntlet a number to telephone after landing in Glasgow. This put him in touch with a pilot who flew regularly to deliver food, wine, and people to the monks in their monastery on the island of Ringmarookie. The pilot was not authorized to fly mail, so that went by sea, much to the disgust of the Holy Fathers. The pilot sounded a very English Englishman on the telephone. Charlie knew the type. Upper-class twit, he told himself, and was then surprised when he turned out to be a woman. The name, he already knew, was vaguely androgynous, Hillary. He had assumed this was a male pilot, as he always presupposed firefighters, policemen and accountants were men, unless otherwise specified. Particularly if you still thought like a male chauvinist porker, which Charlie did for much of the time. But in these days of political correctness, one had to be careful. Never assume was what they had taught in the firm he had previously worked for. It was a lesson never learned, a road not travelled. Hillary Cook, with an E, the young woman told him, all 5'2" of her. 5'2", green eyes, russet hair, snub nose, Carly Simon mouth, and coconut breasts. Charlie mentally christened her the Pina Colada Babe. He had absolutely no doubt that she was a babe, for the eyes were as big as saucers, and she moved in a provocative way, even when she was flying an airplane. They shook hands, and he said, "Of course, Cook with an E," as though this were a grammatical rule. "Lovely bum," he thought, "like two brass rubbings." "You come here often?" They were taxiing out in the minuscule Cessna, and he'd really meant to ask if she flew the route regularly. "Oh, yeah. Had to take the instrument rating exams 4 times before I passed, though. Damned anti-feminist instructors. I was only lost for 30 minutes. Had an hour's fuel left, so I didn't see the problem." Then quickly to ground control. "Oscar Mike, say again, control." Charlie noted that she pronounced "our," "ah." All in all, our Hillary failed to inspire confidence. On takeoff, the Cessna lurched alarmingly and dropped a wing just after becoming airborne. Gauntlet glanced at his pilot and saw her mouth shape a silent expletive, while deep scowl marks appeared on her forehead and between her well-plucked eyebrows. When they reached the cruising altitude of 5,000 feet, well below the dome of thick cloud, Hillary Cook began to talk again, as though takeoff had been merely an interruption in an ongoing conversation.
"Yeah, those damned instructors, all they wanted to do was screw me."
"Ah, terrible." Charlie was not used to such candor from women he'd just met, particularly babes. "What do you do about it? Report them to the pilots' union, or whatever you call it?"
"No. Some were quite nice. I slept with two of them, but it made no difference. They still wouldn't pass me until they were good and ready."
"Or until you were good and ready," Gauntlet thought. He found it oddly disturbing to have a woman he hardly knew describing her sexual attitudes without hesitation. With the subtlety of a climbing boot, he tried to change the conversation. "You know the monks well?"
"There are only two of us in the air freight and taxi business out of Glasgow who get into Ringmarookie."
She took her eyes off the instruments and gave him what might have been meant as a soulful look. Really, it was the one she usually reserved for the monks.
"Actually, that's not altogether true. There are only two of us with small enough aircraft to get in. Not much room on Ringmarookie."
"Thought it was more than 60 square miles. She explained that she was talking about the landing and takeoff space.
"I should call it the runway, but it's not dignified enough to be called a runway."
The good fathers, it appeared, had hacked gorse, heather, scrub and brush out of a flat area close to the monastery walls. She assured him that on a calm day there was plenty of room to take off and land.
"Hour and a half, we'll be there."
She spoke loudly above the engine's roar as the plane jigged along.
"You going to join up?"
"You what?"
"You going to be a monk?"
"In your dreams."
"Sorry, just being polite."
Ringmarookie lies to the west of Scotland, some 25 miles out past the Outer Hebrides. Sir Francis Drake made one reference to the island, calling it a pebble thrown into the wild ocean, and indeed it could be a turbulent place,
for there is nothing to prevent Atlantic storms from sweeping across its mostly flat, ungovernable terrain, as Abraham Ortelius, the 16th century Flemish mapmaker, described it. No man, he wrote, would willingly wish to live on this knob of scrubby stone and rock. I would fain live in a coracle at the mercy of the deep than on this brutal raft. Seeing Ringmarocki for the first time from the air, Gauntlet agreed, wondering why anybody could banish themselves to this remote place. Then, as the Cessna tipped and banked over the southern end of the island, the sun slid momentarily from the clouds, bringing the island to life, so that it became a rock-encrusted green, red, and grey jewel, surrounded by the foam and waves of an inhospitable sea. The angry stone outline, like a drying scab at the edge of a wound set in a blue-grey body. A great scar, a crescent about a mile and a half long and almost a mile wide, was visible at the southern end of the island, as though a mechanical digger had gouged a chunk from the earth. This was, in fact, the remains of the quarry from which the stone had been cut, for Ringmarocki's one structure, the monastery of St. Jerome. From the quarry to the monastery walls, the monks had neatly tilled and planted the earth. Half of it had been seeded with grass over a long period, and now sheep and cattle grazed happily. The remainder was quilted out in plots that were obviously handed over to individual monks responsible for growing vegetables for the refectory table. As they lost height, heading north up the western coast, Charlie had his first clear view of the monastery itself, a brown and grey Gothic complex that reminded him of his Cambridge College, St. John's. A chapel topped by a chunky Norman tower was at the heart of the building. In turn, the chapel lay within two cloistered courts, the inner backed onto turreted buildings that, Gauntlet was later to discover, housed the monastic quarters, lodges, and grass studded by occasional park benches and a pair of formal rose gardens. All this Charlie took in as Hilary Cook prepared for the landing, dipping the Cessna into a sharp 90-degree turn to the right, bringing them to the west of the northern tip of the island. They were coming in low over the sea, and Gauntlet felt his stomach lurch. His hands were wrapped tightly in white-knuckled fists, and he was conscious of swallowing hard as he clearly saw the small oblong of green that marked the boundaries of the makeshift runway. From where he sat, he had severe doubts about the length of the chopped-out flat area. The Cessna crossed the boiling surf and the cliffs, with Charles still biting back the fear in his throat, as Hilary, the daredevil aviatrix, shouted something about being too high. The aircraft's nose yawed to the right as the left wing dipped in a sideslip. She throttled back and quickly lost height. Just in time, it seemed, the Cessna leveled off, and with a reassuring bump, the gear thumped onto the resisting ground. "Jolly good, eh?" Hilary drawled as she pumped the brakes, slowing the aircraft. "Fantastic." He was simply happy to be alive. Glancing to the right, he saw the monastery rising like another cliff face. From the air, there was only the impression of size. Suddenly, on landing, there was a mammoth building. Charlie thought briefly that he should not have been surprised to find the monastery so massive, for the huge quarry to the south reflected the amount of stone that had gone into the building. The Cessna taxied back to park some 50 feet from the gatehouse, where he now saw Kit Palfrey standing with a tall, thin, black-cloaked figure, both of them clinging conspiratorially to the wall, almost merging with the stone. The little aircraft was dwarfed like a toy next to the outer cloister, with the height of the chapel tower looming up against the lowering sky. "I have a few things for the Father Superior," Hilary said as she switched off the engine. "I won't be going back for an hour or so, if you want to catch a lift."
"Unhappily, I fear that I'll be staying, and it's not really my scene."
He did not even smile to lighten the load, but spoke as he felt. It was many years since he'd come into contact with organized religion, and his view of the monastic life was coloured mainly by such movies as The Nun Story, Shoes of the Fisherman, and Dare He Think It, from back in the dark days, Brother Orchid, with Edward G. Robinson.
in black and white.